This is the Fourth Estate, right here on RCR.
Hello, this is the Fourth Estate, back for the first show of 2025, Reality Check Radio's love letter to the journalism our democracy deserves, appropriately recorded on this cloudy St. Valentine's Day. I'm your host, Marty Gibson, and joining us today is our favourite sharp-tongued, train-driving, gun-toting, award-winning, column-writing, Trump-loving lady, Rachel Stewart. Good morning,
morning,
Rachel.
Marty.
Thanks so much for joining us again on the Fourth Estate.
It's not cloudy where I am, just letting you know that.
Gosh, that's another inaccuracy that we've got in the media. and our other guest, a halfling with a whole lot of knowledge on internet and media law and so much more, former judge, mastermind winner and blogger at A Halfling's View, David Harvey. Welcome back, David.
Thank you. Thank you, Marty. And it's just a little bit cloudy here, but very warm and just perfect.
Oh, good, good. Well, this is like one of those cliched scenes in a movie where someone comes in after a pivotal event and asks, what did I miss? There's so much to catch up on. And it seems that the media has not only missed most of it, but has done their best to ensure the rest of us miss it too. We're waking up this morning to histrionics in the New Zealand media as the news reaches us of JFK Jr.'s confirmation as Health and Human Services Secretary. But there's not a lot of teasing out of his promise to make America healthy again. Last week, there were the revelations arising from the audit and suspension of the United States Agency for Investment and Development, or USAID. I said on RCR's new show, The Daily Brief, it's a bit like trying to drink from a fire hydrant at the moment. But as people with a fondness for America, I'm guessing we're all lapping up as much as we can. Rachel, have you been enjoying the show?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what are you, 24 days into Trump's presidency, and there's so much to take in and so much fun. I mean, I can't disagree with anything he's done. And, you know, plastic straws are good.
Oh, yeah, I ordered a whole lot online just a few weeks ago in case they were going to run out. But just on that score, we hosted a couple of friends from Arizona yesterday around Auckland, showing them the sites. And the comment that they made was, hey, Trump gets things done.
Yeah.
That, you know, that seems to sort of sum it up. Wouldn't you agree, Rachel?
Oh, yeah, he's getting stuff done. And you know, the work rate on that man, he defies gravity, really. He's 78 years old. It's, I mean, I'm tired and I'm 62. That man does not get tired. He just keeps going. He's incredible. He's a powerhouse. And I think we've seen a lot of his personality on display very clearly the last few weeks, reading out the executive orders, the way he has greeted people that he's managed to get out of Belarus and the Middle East. He's been incredibly gracious and funny. It's hard to love the man more. I mean, especially when he was talking about the plastic straws and versus the paper ones. And he's talking about, you know, I don't think the sharks are going to be too worried about it as they're munching through the ocean. I mean, you know, he's just, maybe they are, I don't know. But the fact is that he's funny, he's humorous, he's lighthearted, he's a different person from the last term.
Yeah, he really is, isn't he?
He really is.
Yeah, it helps when you've got a Republican Congress and Senate, though.
It does, and it also helps when someone tries to kill you and you're a whisker away from death. I mean, you know, it was so close, and I think he's found his God or whatever he's found. He's got a different relationship with the divine anyway, whatever that means. But
He's got a different team around him too, hasn't he? And I mean, that's been the other really exciting thing is seeing some of those people, and I hardly dared hope that we'd be at this stage. I must admit, I was prepared to be disappointed and see it for another ruse to just continue doing more of the same. But it really, and it's showing up this is another description from the 3-minute bit I did. It makes Luxon and Co's teaspooning out of our own swamp look even more anemic, doesn't it?
Absolutely right. I couldn't. I think that Luxon's got a problem on his hands. The tide is shifting, and you know, things like this. And I've been a fighter for the trans anti. Let's call it anti-trans because I am anti-trans, really. movement for a long time, and to see him signing the sports bill where men are no longer allowed in women's sports, and he had all the little girls around him, and he had the teenage girl athletes, and then he had the mothers and the aunts surrounding him, and he's giving them out pens. I don't know if any of you saw that, but it was a very moving moment, particularly for me. I was very moved by that, to see these women, young women, you know. And apparently he's the biggest misogynist on earth. Maybe, I don't know, if that's misogyny, bring it on.
Well, I've swum competitively when I was younger, and you know, it is a dull sport to train in. That black line just going underneath you, and just the sound of your own breathing. And so I had a reasonable amount of insight into how much it would have crushed those women to have lost to a man after all that training.
Well, I was down at the pool this morning, Marty, 5 o'clock, Olympic pool in Auckland, my 1 kilometre, same pool that I competed in years and years and years ago. The bottom hasn't changed.
I always, the first length is always beautiful. I can just feel myself lifted out of the water, powering along. I turn, the turn feels good, come back, and I'm smelling the chlorine, and then I do another turn. I'm thinking, oh, that's right.
Yeah, and then it just gets slower and slower and slower.
I start getting more dugong-like.
Unless we forget that the swimming's one thing, but, you know, Riley Gaines, you know, was talking about what it was like to have to undress in front of Leah Thomas, and he's fully intact watching her in the changing rooms. And, I mean, that's a big aspect of it too. It's not just sport. It's all of that, and that's still a hill we have to climb. So we, you know, in New Zealand particularly, nothing's changed there. So we shall see about puberty blockers and all this other garbage in the next year or two. But if Luxon doesn't start sniffing the bath salts, he's toast, I'd say.
Well, yeah, it's very odd, isn't it? I mean, Matt Ducey is meant to be a really good friend of his. And, you know, his association with the Tavistock Institute, I thought, would have, just for the optics, have ruled out his being put in charge of mental health. But yeah, they're really determined to die on that hill, it seems. And as the father of two young girls who, you know, I take to the pools to go swimming and watch who's going in with some trepidation, I must say, to be told prior to the election by Luxon that if I'm worried about that, I'm on another planet, is particularly... I wouldn't say galling, but it is galling, but it's more than that. It's a very odd thing to say.
Well, it's a disconnect, isn't it? And if he hasn't learnt from seeing Trump win, you know, resoundingly, and they did the ratings on the ads that cut through, and the biggest one was, you know, Kamala Harris is for they, them, but, you know, he's for you. That was the biggest cut through they had for an ad. I don't know where Luxon's at. I don't think he's very bright. That's what I've come to. I think he's a bit thick.
Well, I think he's been installed to give the illusion of doing one thing while carrying on an agenda that's not saleable to the wider public, much the same as Ardern was. Yes. Everyone sort of, you know, she was very skillful at appearing to be the people's champion while essentially, well, initially carrying out WEF agenda, and then subsequently, you know, going to Harvard because that's the nexus where academia meets the blob and meets the pharmaceutical industry. Some people are still slow to get that.
Not to mention the $1 million advance for the autobiography.
Yeah, well,
a real socialist, that one.
They were betting, and I think in much the same way as Luxon was betting, as he effusively praised Obama and mocked Trump, that we were going to have President Harris now. And so it's interesting seeing those readjustments. And our producer says to me quite exasperatedly, look, this USAID stuff's not new. It's been going on for ages. And so many of those things are like that. They're there if you've got a mind to find them. But so many people are... you know, accepting what they're seeing in the media on the face of it. And it's the media are doing a rearguard action, but I would imagine it's going to get harder and harder for them to do it.
Well, whatever you say, wherever in any sort of situation, if you're taking money, if you're taking somebody's dollar, unless you make sure that you distance yourself from that particular source, there is always going to be a question mark. It may just be optics. You know, how much of the how much spin follows as a result of that money, and we only have to look at the way in which the Public Interest Journalism Fund was received and the criticism that that has received as well. It's absolutely critical that media organizations retain their integrity, and it's not enough for them to say, "Oh yes, well we are truly independent," and so on and so forth. Okay, that's fine. Show it. Show it. And they don't.
Well, I mean, this has reached New Zealand by proxy through Internews' work with Group M and their news site vetting project, which was essentially the way the people who print the money and own the private equity firms that own the corporations that do the advertising impose their will on the news. That launched in with a hiss and a roar actually in October 2023, with some high profile New Zealand journalists pushing it. But the reporting on the defunding of USAID hasn't focused on this at all, has it? I saw a One News segment that had a heartbreaking tale about children waiting in the hot sun for their TB medication, which Bjorn Lomborg said was the most effective public spending that you could do in terms of if you count every human as equal in value, eradicating TB, you know, would get rid of one of humanity's biggest blights. So that's what they chose to be emblematic of the work that USAID was doing. But they haven't talked about all the money that's gone to the New York Times, gone to Reuters. And there's an invoice. I don't know if you've seen the invoice circulating. It's when it's got for services rendered, the services are for public deception or something like.
Oh dear. Oh my. They
It's
did actually
astonishing
write
how
something like that. Oh dear.
flagrant it was. The initiative, Internews, the Group M initiative, had it was fronted by Michael Mora, who's actually a journalist that I really respect in New Zealand. He's probably, I think, New Zealand's best journalists,
Yeah, I
in many,
agree.
one
I
of them.
agree with, yeah, definitely.
Jane Currie, you know, who we often quote here, is another, you know, he's a serious journalist. But there was a real their argument was that there's been a drop in ad investment in news in recent years, and the newsroom has borne the brunt of the erosion of the advertising revenue. And so, you know, it was a system whereby they could say, oh, we're not going to report on things that are beyond the pale. So if you can just send all the advertising revenue our way, there's going to be some residual effect of that. I wonder how quickly it's going to tail off and what changes it's going to create. What do you think, David? Like, as how can we know that that influence is waning?
Well, I it's difficult to say because the simple answer is you don't. Until the organizations or whatever start to demonstrate their true independence. And that, I think, is where the answer probably lies. And it's one of the reasons why I think organizations like RCR and your competition in the platform are so important, because you do offer an alternative position. You may be funded from various organizations, but you demonstrate your independence by being completely neutral across the board and putting forward every particular point of view, which is a good way to do it. My concern, and we may talk about this later, is that that particular independence, if you like, is under threat, but we'll get to that later on.
Well, I mean, it's a useful segue into it because we are seeing some continuations of this blob coordinated war on misinformation. And by the blob, for those of you who are not familiar with Mike Benz, who used to work for the State Department's excellent work, I thoroughly recommend it to you in terms of understanding what's behind a lot of this. But the war on misinformation is very much a part of what they've done and their horror at populist politicians. And here in New Zealand, the Broadcasting Standards Authority have a new proposal to regulate streaming services, which, David's very much in your wheelhouse. And it's a year and a half ago, the Department of Internal Affairs closed their consultation with Safer Online Services and Platforms, which was effectively an online censorship regime. Then everything's gone quiet, hasn't it?
Yep, it has. And there's sort of been mutterings in the background from time to time, sort of associated with the Fair Digital News bargaining business. But the Broadcasting Standards Authority is past its use-by date in its current form. And, you know, the legislation was passed in 1989. But what the Broadcasting Standards Authority regulates is broadcast. And there is that involves the use of spectrum and getting licenses for spectrum, which means that outfits like TVNZ, TV3, Radio New Zealand, all of the various radio stations that broadcast on a frequency are subject to Broadcasting Standards Authority jurisdiction. And they set out codes of conduct. And there have been various codes of conduct over the years. And I know that something like about 7 or 8 years ago, I consulted on a code of conduct for the digital space, because they realized the old codes of conduct weren't fit for purpose. So that's okay. So you've got, and now you now have one code of conduct that covers all of broadcasting, TV, radio, the whole lot. And those codes of conduct form the basis of how the Broadcasting Standards Authority addresses and deals with complaints. So if people want to complain, the Broadcasting Standards Authority measures the particular broadcast against the code of conduct to see whether or not it complies. That's not a problem. And I have no difficulty with that, because since the 1920s, the state has been involved in broadcasting, and you're never going to get the iron hand of the state off radio and TV. It's always going to be there. And although they say RNZ is independent, TVNZ is independent, they are not. They are linked inextricably to the state, which is why outfits like private radio and now internet radio and internet TV and so on and so forth are so important, because they do not fulfill the definition of broadcast in that they don't use spectrum. You go out online. And this is wonderful. I mean, this is an example of how the digital paradigm completely disrupts previous business models. So now we have outfits like RCR and like the platform and various others that can provide an alternative. So what the new proposals are suggesting, along with a whole lot of other stuff, is that these platforms will become absorbed into Broadcasting Standards Authority jurisdiction. And it won't just include broadcast, it will be basically dissemination. So if you're disseminating a point of view and you're disseminating it within a public context, then you could possibly fall within the jurisdiction and restrictions and regulation of a Broadcasting Standards Authority. Completely incorrect name. Broadcasting is defunct. The funny thing about it is that that will include online newspapers and so on and so forth, but online newspapers and traditional news journalism is covered by the News Media Standards Council, which is the inheritor of the Press Council, and is a voluntary organization. So you're going to have two organizations, in fact, who are going to be running against one another, or in tandem, if you like, because of the fact that there's a lot of convergence. For example, the Herald does media They don't do video. So are they a broadcaster? You know, what exactly are they? Are they like television, or are they like a newspaper, or what are they? Of course, they're a newspaper. They're not a broadcaster because they're not using broadcast frequency to do that. But that's the way that it goes. Big problem. That means that outfits like RCR and the platform and all of the others will possibly be subject to this. And one of the things that I know RCR and the platform are broadcast, well, put out there, if you like, is we are not subject to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. We are separate from them. We are truly independent. And the problem is that once you fall under the watchful eye of a regulator, you are not. And there's an issue.
It's interesting because, you know, when people first started buying and selling online, there was this fear that there was going to be an epidemic of fraud, but there wasn't. People trusted each other with large sums of money often because they wanted to preserve their reputation as an honest dealer. And I wonder if the new push for legislation factors that in. I mean, one of the reasons we, well, I'll speak for myself, but I think I can speak more widely for RCR anyway. One of the reasons we don't go around saying stupid things that we can't defend is because we want to maintain a reputation
Sure.
as a sober, considered source of information.
Yeah, hard to achieve and easy to lose. But
Yes.
the other thing about these proposals is that if you are talking about regulating the dissemination of information, organizations like Substack will become subject to this type of thing. And
What
that
about someone with a large social media following who might do a live stream? Are they a broadcaster under this regulation?
I'm not exactly sure, but I think there are some exceptions proposed for sort of things like Facebook and instant messaging
Yeah.
and all of that type of thing.
Now, Rachel, you've in your former incarnation as a journalist or a columnist, you've been critical of water quality that comes from dairying practices. So you've had some experience in what it's like to speak truth to power, and it can be uncomfortable, isn't it? There are concerns that you have around that from that point of view of it compromising people's ability to speak truth to power.
Oh, absolutely. Noticed that when I went to the Herald, the ability to speak about the dairy industry became markedly different. And, you know, I think about my third column in, I woke up to see the print version online, and it had been completely messed with. And I rang Murray Kirkness and talked to him about that, and all the subbies had taken out Dairy NZ and various words about Fonterra. And it wasn't that anything was wrong. It was just that they decided to cut and hack. And this just kept going until I realised and was told quite clearly that Dairy NZ had invited the Herald for a meeting, or they were at a meeting where they got together, and I was discussed in great detail. So from that point on, things started changing. And Dairy NZ, sorry, Dairy NZ, who's the research arm of dairy farming, had given the Herald quite a bit of money to run a thing called, I can't remember now, but it was something like Clean Waters, or, you know, some of this propaganda about what they're doing, about water quality. At the time, it was propaganda. Maybe it's a little bit better now. And I realised how interfered I'd been with, how I'd been interfered with, I should say. And
In the
they
nicest
weren't
possible way, Rachel.
in the nicest possible way. And it was about the money, and the Herald made it perfectly clear. But they didn't want to say too much. They just kept making it untenable for me to keep talking about that subject. So that was the first experience I had really of censorship at that
Yeah,
point, you know.
I had a similar experience writing stories about a sub-tribe on the East Coast. I won't necessarily name the iwi involved, but and their claim had been subsumed. David, you'll correct me if that's the wrong word. Had been absorbed by the other iwi who had actually propagated the injustices against this sub-tribe had absorbed their claim. So the tribe who were responsible for, oh, it was Ngāti Porou, you know, they'd sided with the crown, and it was they'd come after some of these sub-tribes, and they had a claim for land lost and various other things. And yeah, I got the call. The story you've written isn't gonna run. And it was in no small part because the Runanga did a lot of advertising with the paper. So it doesn't even. And I think there was a threat of legal action as well, which is enough for a small local paper to fold. So
or a big one like the Herald. And of course, the next experience was writing a column about the trans movement and self-ID coming in. That was 2018, and we've got it now. And I was warning people where that was going to go and how that was going to look. And everything's come to pass. And it went to the press, it went to the Media Council. I have absolutely zero respect for the Media Council. They completely didn't understand the subject. They completely backed the trans lobbyists. They said that I said, I actually feel when I look at the decision they made about that column, it was basically trans activists taking me to task. En masse, that the Media Council, I'm owed an apology. Their judgment was just so ridiculous. All of it's come true. And there would be nothing on there that I should have been pinged with. And oh boy. And that's the only column I see that the Herald seems to have online at the moment about me. Oh, I did hundreds of columns. That's the only one that seems to be still up from 2018 that I've noticed with all the Media Council pings all over it. And I was saying that people were taking puberty blockers at young ages, and all of this has come to pass. But anyway, the Herald did not defend me very well, and that was the beginning of the end, basically.
Yeah, there's often putting the cart before the horse, isn't there, where you'll get an agency like that saying, okay, we're going to put some guidelines in place to ensure there's no misinformation, and there's a real need for someone to say, hey, take a few steps back. Are you neutral? What are the existing pressures against honesty?
And to be fair to the Herald, just one thing. The thing was, I was a bit ahead of the curve. And when you're a little bit ahead of the curve, people have to catch up. And the Herald didn't even know what they didn't know. So I couldn't even explain to them. And they didn't want to take a good look at what was happening in other countries and where I was getting my information and why I believed what I did and why it's all come true. So the bottom line is, if you're ahead of the curve, good luck with media who are still catching up. I mean, you're dealing with people who really don't seem to have they had the time, I'm pretty sure, but they don't have the wherewithal to do the research. And so a columnist that was ahead of them on that was too much for them. They just couldn't deal. Anyway, just making that point.
The problem is that you're dealing with, and this is... for the media as well as all sorts of other areas of society, you're dealing with groupthink. And there is an orthodox point of view. Now, I've always been in favor of the opportunity for anybody who has a different point of view to get up and have an opportunity to say it and not be shot because they put their head above the parapet, but to have their argument listened to. And I've recently had an experience of that, but anyway.
Which we're coming to.
but you know, get the idea out there and let's talk about the idea, and don't dismiss it because it's unorthodox. Examine it because it actually might have something to say. And I think, Rachel, that's exactly the position that you were in back in the day, when you were saying this is coming down the track and we need to think about it, but hey, no, actually we don't, because there are a whole lot of issues as far as orthodox thinking is concerned that we actually don't want to turn this rock over because we're afraid of what it's going to unleash. But there's nothing to be afraid of with different ideas. That's, you know, heavens above.
Interesting what you call orthodox when you think about it. When I think about orthodox, I don't think of men in dresses in my changing rooms or men in dresses in rape crisis centres. Or I don't think of, I don't know, there's so many things, the world's so upside down.
The human rights people, you know, they say discrimination and, you know, automatically that shuts the debate down.
Yeah, dead right.
Yes. Yeah, it's an interesting thing that a lot of, I mean, I certainly have come around to it in the past 4 years or so. That strange rule that if there are 10 people and one person has a dissenting voice, that one person is more likely to be correct than the nine. It's a big Solomon Ash conformity experiment. And I guess on that note, David, let's have a chat about your oral submission to the Treaty Principles Bill, and the treatment you received there, because I was watching Willie Jackson tell you that the creme de la creme of legal minds in New Zealand thought one thing and you thought the other. What are you?
I got a two-word thing that I can't say on radio.
We should bleep it out. It would make
Point of
it.
view, you know, but all right, okay, here's the deal. Treaty Principles Bill. First thing, what does the bill say? Let's read the bill and see what it says. And so I did that, and it's really simple. It's only about 9 or 10 clauses. You know, for a lawyer, it's 5 minutes' work. For anybody else, it may be 10, but it is very simple. And I thought to myself, you know, there's all of this business about rewriting the treaty and all of that sort of thing, but this bill doesn't do that. It
No.
doesn't say that. In fact, it says the treaty's going to be preserved. What it does say is these are the principles that the court's got to take into account when it's doing treaty stuff. So I had a look at it, and the first principle was that, you know, there's to be the government. The government governs. All right. So I thought about that, and I thought, well, hold on. We have these existing principles already of partnership and fair dealing and equity and recompense and all of the rest of it. Those are, in fact, parts of ordinary government. The government is a partnership between the people and the government. You know, the government governs with the consent of the governed. It's a knife that cuts both ways, and that thinking has been part of liberal democracy since the beginning of the 19th century. Edmund Burke, and I cited Edmund Burke in my submission, and I said, look, this bill actually incorporates the existing principles that the courts and the Waitangi Tribunal have decided as part of the governing structure. So you really don't need to worry. And this is something that we should be looking at. So let's get this bill before the people and have a discussion about it. That in essence was the submission. That was the argument. It was a nice, neat little, it was a lawyer's argument, I admit, but hey, that's what I do. So I get invited to address the submission at the select committee. And when I was in practice and when I was mentoring young lawyers after I retired from the bench, I had a thing called the three P's that lawyers should always do for, you know, advocates. First thing is preparation. Second thing is punctuality, be there on time. And the third thing is presentation. If you get those three lined up, you're probably going to do a good job. So I prepared for my select committee appearance of 10 minutes. And I pulled my submission apart and read it and considered it and rethought it and did a little summary of it and so on and so forth. And I wasn't asked a single question about it. And I went along there to have my ideas tested. I wanted to have that concept tested, and it never happened. Instead, I get told by Willie Jackson that I'm out of sync. Well, okay, so what? Why is it that the majority suddenly has the right point of view when they may all be wrong? But he doesn't see it that way. Then I get taken to task by Rawiri Waititi. I get a lecture about Brown and the Board of Education, which was a case of the United States Supreme Court, which started the civil rights thing. And I was alive when that happened. I remember Brown. I don't think Waititi was alive at the time, but anyway, I remember it. So he doesn't lecture me about the civil rights movement. I was in the United States when the damn civil rights bill was enacted in 1964. So don't lecture me about that. And then he accuses me, he says, the thinking behind your submission, which he obviously hadn't read, is why so many Maori were being sentenced when you were a judge. And I thought, what? I mean, that was a real assault on my judicial integrity. But then he gave me an opening, you don't have any respect for the rule of law. So I was able to bring the rule of law argument back. And that was okay. So Waititi hadn't read the submission. Jackson hadn't read the submission. If they had read it, they probably didn't understand it because they are bears of very little brain. And then I get questioned by Duncan Webb. Now, Duncan Webb is a professor of law, and I'm thinking this is the one guy that I might expect to have a decent discussion with. But no, he goes off into some bloody tangent about the Sentencing Act.
Which party is Duncan
He's
Webb?
Labour. Labour.
He's Right.
Labour. So there I am. I've done my submission. I've done all of the work. I've done all of the preparation. I was on time. I thought that my presentation was okay. I tried to keep on track on subject, but they weren't interested in discussing that. Now, I've always thought the Select Committee was where the hard work in Parliament was done. I don't think any work was done on that one. I was prepared. They were not. That was absolutely simple. I mean, hell's teeth. If it had been a different situation, if I'd been the judge and they'd been the advocates, I would have reamed them for that little preparation. But
It
they
sounds
didn't.
like you came away from that a sadder and wiser man, David, do you?
I've always been of the view that the democracy, our democracy, our liberal democracy, is good. And I had evidence to support that. And I've lived under a liberal democracy all of my life and have supported that. Now, I'm afraid that my feelings about liberal democracy, and I don't normally get into the feeling thing, but my feelings about liberal democracy are now an article of faith. It's kind of like belief in God. You can't prove that it's there, but you'd like to think that it is.
And you can behave as if it is so.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I intend to continue to do so. And if I have to make a submission to a select committee, maybe I'll approach it in a slightly different way and do what Geoffrey Palmer does, which is lecture them.
Yeah.
Well, I had my illusion shattered when I watched the select committee on self-ID, and I watched all these women talking to Deborah Russell of Labor and
Oh,
Jenny
wow. Yeah, that was
Anderson.
awful.
You remember that?
Yep.
And it was absolutely appalling. And yeah, I just thought that this is democracy is just about done. When they're rolling their eyes and calling them names and you just hate trans people. No, I actually like I love women. I'm actually here for women's rights, but they kept, which is what we're all in it for. And yeah, I was appalled at the treatment that those submitters in good faith got. So I feel you, David. I feel you.
Yeah, but let's face it, Rachel, the people that you're talking about and the people that I'm talking about are exactly the same. They are left-wing ideologues.
Yes, they are. They're
And, you know,
Marxists, in fact. They're
yeah,
Marxists, in fact.
and
Let's
that,
call it what it is.
and because they are unprepared or unwilling to entertain that there might be some validity in an opposing point of view, means that you're never going to be able to get that opposing point of view through.
Absolutely.
Frankly, I don't give a shit if 50%, 50 KCs disagree with me. Fine. I am prepared to debate 50 KCs. Just bring it on.
That's you're
And
dead right.
let's have a discussion about that. And if you can persuade me that I'm wrong, I will concede that point because a free discussion and an exchange of ideas in a respectful and courteous manner is the way that you get to truth, whatever that might be.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Marxism. We're dealing with people who hate logic, who
Oh, yeah.
think that everyone's got their own truth, and the arguments are almost all either on Willie Jackson's, everyone else thinks differently to you, thing, or else there's a straw man argument. You just hate Maori. You just hate trans people. And there's
Veto
no
word, veto
effort
words, mate.
to.
Veto words.
Yeah, well, I think there are perfectly valid reasons for Maori to want to separate themselves from the orthodoxy of society, and I share many of them.
Yep.
And if we have the debate in a respectful, careful way that teases out the issues, I think it's very exciting where we might get to on there.
Well, I got a message this morning on through the email about a seminar that's being held that discusses how you can have parallel courts running in the United States that deal with Native American issues in conjunction with established legal principles, and how you can have this sort of duality of courts dealing with these problems. Now, yeah, I have no difficulty with that, as long as everybody gets treated equally and fairly.
So, well, how can you do that if you've... I mean, what about Sharia courts in the UK? Do you have a
problem? Well, yeah, okay. Sharia is a little bit different because that... You're dealing with a faith-based system, and you know, by its very definition, if it's an article of faith, it is completely contrary to reason, because faith requires a belief in something that you can't prove. And you know, I mean, you can't prove the existence of God, so you believe in it, and if you believe in it strongly, that's fine, that's okay. Now, the thing is that the Sharia thing is based upon the Quran, and that's all tied up with that faith-based system. Now, that means that you are applying that particular belief that you have to everybody else who may not believe in it. And that's
well,
why...
their argument is that they just want to deal with their community of believers within that system, and that's what they want. Which is
okay. There's no reason. There's
no. If you've got a six-year-old girl,
be dealt with according to Sharia law, as long as it doesn't exclude the jurisdiction of the domestic court or the domestic system.
And just getting back to the treaty principles bill, what were your thoughts on the addition that Seymour made to it? To the extent that Maori could continue to go to court to try and do things that they were doing at the time of the signing of the treaty?
Look, not a problem about that, because that is part of the right of redress that they already have under the existing principles, and that is part of any system where the state commits a wrong. You are entitled to be compensated from the state for that wrong. So I don't have any difficulty about that. What Seymour is saying is that those decisions about claims that Maori might have to be determined in accordance with the principles bill. And my argument is that bill doesn't necessarily exclude the ideas of partnership and so on and so forth. It actually incorporates them as part of the deal that the government has with the government. So I don't have too much of a difficulty with that.
Did you have any
reservations?
If the state
does a wrong to anybody, they're entitled to be compensated, not just Māori.
Was there anything in the bill that you found questionable?
Really.
Luxon was asked this, and he was asked, is there anything, you know, what don't you like about the bill? And he said, everything.
Well, yeah, I mean... he said that it's everything. He said it's simplistic. And he said, you're trying to rewrite 184 years of history. Okay, I would say that the answer that he's given is simplistic. It probably demonstrates that although he's read the bill, he doesn't understand it. And even if he has read the bill, he hasn't actually thought about it and thought about its implications. He sees it as... something that is going to divide society, and it will. There's no question about that. But you know, I mean, if you're a good Marxist, you believe in that sort of dialectic anyway, where something synthesizes out of conflict. But so I can't understand why Labour's so against it. But His response was simplistic. It's a man who doesn't want to engage with the discussion, and he doesn't want to engage with a lot of discussions. And you only have to look at the way in which he addresses media conferences. I mean, it's business speak all the way. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. I'm staying on message. I'm staying on message. I'm staying on message. I mean, you know,
I'm
do
thinking
they
about the
plug him in?
Deloitte
Do they
job I can
plug him
get.
in the morning?
What's that?
Do they plug him in the morning? I don't know.
My suspicion is that he's thinking about the wonderful big boys jobs he can get now he's got Prime Minister on a CV. And I
Right.
think that explains a lot of his imperviousness to relentless criticism by actual National Party supporters to what they're doing around climate change, around the trans agenda, around race-based law. I think he's quite plugged into BlackRock's DEI
Yeah.
principles, and
Oh, yeah.
that's, I suspect, his primary loyalty.
Yeah.
Well, just and another thing that I suspect he's on the wrong side of history with is fluoride and the forcing of local government to add it to their water. So we saw Winston Peters introduce his fluoride referendum bill. I've got here, you know, the Sean Plunkett interviewed. It seems to be his thing to call anyone who believes in any of that a cooker, which is, I try not to respond to that, but
Never worked that one out.
no, it hasn't caught on the way he'd hoped, I don't think. But what do you, where's the journalism on this? The latest science, nor the public opposition to water fluoridation seems to get consideration in this reporting. What's the importance of it to them, do you think?
Well,
Who? Oh, sorry.
here you go, Rachel. Go.
Is it orthodoxy again?
Yep.
It's anti-RFK. It's anti everything, anti-vax. It's anti, it's incredible. I mean, the fluoride thing fascinates me because I grew up rurally and I never and but I would go to my grandmother's in New Plymouth and we'd have Christmas there. And she always had the most horrible smelling water because it was fluoridated. It was fluoridated up there for years. It's always been. And in Whanganui. And on the farm, that wasn't a thing. So for me, I've always struggled with this, and I've struggled with the fact that my teeth are pretty good; they're fine. That you can take your own fluoride toothpaste, you can take your own fluoride pills if you want to. But the issue that I find now, growing up and having a house in town, is imagine for and we Whanganui hasn't done this yet, but imagine forcing people to take something into their body that they don't want. We've been here before, haven't we?
But well, we have Rachel, and this is a classic example of nanny state knows best. You know, fluoride is good for you. Okay, well, there may be some issue about that. You're not going to have a choice about this. We know what's best for you, so we're going to put fluoride in the water, and by guess or by God, you are damn well going to drink it because it's good for you. So that opportunity to choose is taken away from you. Now, you mentioned fluoride toothpaste, you mentioned fluoride tablets. Those are the alternatives that individuals who want to take fluoride can adopt. Personally, I don't mind the fluoride in the water. It makes it easy and I don't have to remember to take a pill. And as I get older, I sometimes forget to take my meds and it's a problem. But the thing that and this is part of my sort of advocacy for contrarianism. If people don't want to do it, they shouldn't be damn well compelled, and particularly by the state. And there, you know, one thing that I do like when I go up to our place at the beach is that I've got two ways of getting there. One is by a toll road, and the other is by a free road. And there's always got to be a free alternative to a toll road, and I think that's extra good. Now, you know, that's nice. I'm not compelled to go on the toll road, and I don't go on the toll road because I'm a miser. But you know, it should be the
The
same.
$2. The
No,
two dollars.
$2.60 one way, Marty.
Oh
Oh
my
my
wow.
gosh, you've got to
But
remember the 60
what's
cents.
it to Sean Plunkett? This is the bit that fascinates me. What's it to him that if somebody doesn't want to comply with forced fluoridation. And I'm
Margaret
one of them.
Cooker.
I don't, you know, what's it to him? What's it
Well,
to him
I
if
mean,
I don't take a vaccine? What's it to him?
Yeah, I
can we
mean, it's my
speculate that
choice.
I agree with your drive for choice, David. I mean, from my perspective anyway, the days of accepting when a public health official says, the science says this, do this, don't question it, or we're going to come at you with some ad hominem attack. When Ashley Bloomfield used the word cooker, that was peak incandescent rage for me. It was like, how dare you?
Yep.
How dare you?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the thing about it, Marty, is that people, particularly in the bureaucracy and in government, forget why they're there. And it is not to wield power. It is not to tell people what to do. It is not to look upon the citizenry as some herd that's got to be managed with sheepdogs, excuse me, Rachel, or something like that. In fact, they are our servants.
Mm.
They do what we tell them to do. The
We're
only
paying
thing,
them.
the
We're
only thing,
paying them.
Yep, the only thing we rely upon them for is their judgment. And I tell you, that judgment is being questioned day by day.
Well, a useful rule that I arrived at through COVID is never take health advice from people who think there are too many people on the planet. I found that hasn't let me down so far.
Yeah, well, there have been people talking about too many people on the planet for a long time. There was a book by John Brunner in the 1960s called Stand on Zanzibar, where they reckoned that the entire population of the world could be accommodated on the island of Zanzibar off the east coast of Africa. It was a brilliant story about overpopulation,
Right.
and it's still valid now, even although, you know, the numbers have grown a wee bit since 1960.
Well, I think that's us pretty much done in terms of topics. Rachel, I understand that we can look forward to you doing some more work with RCR. Can you tease that out, or is that under wraps? Is there
no,
commercial
I'm working
sensitivity
on it now.
About it?
Well,
Have you got a working title?
Well, maybe riding shotgun, you know, it sort of fits. But basically, I'm going to be doing a sort of a 20 to 30 minute slot every week, which is, you know, kind of hard work, but talking about my having an opinion on a topic and putting in clips and basically being quite entertaining, I hope. And yeah, well, hopefully I'll get an audience. I don't think I'll be doing any interviews, which is the easy part, Marty.
Yeah.
And I'll basically have to fill that hole and make people entertained and talk about the topic of the week. So that's, I think, starting next Friday. I'm still waiting to hear exactly what's happening.
Well,
but I've got the microphone. I've got the microphone. I've got the headphones. I've got the webcam. I'm all go. And the
Your
green
hair's
screen.
Looking good. You've got nice glasses.
Just my old hobby shop glasses, you know, $3 jobs.
Is that right? I don't pay more
don't
than
they look
$2
good?
For mine.
That's right. David would like that. He's a miser.
Absolutely.
What have you got on next, David? Are you?
Well,
actually, I meant to ask you. Sorry to interrupt my own question. What was your doctorate on? What did you do your doctorate in?
Little story. Law and technology, Marty.
Right.
Yeah, I was interested. I taught law and information technology for 18 years. And during the course of that, I thought, you know, there's probably something here that needs to be looked at. Because the digital technology was expanding at such an incredible rate, I thought I'll go back 500 years and have a look at the way in which the printing press impacted upon law and legal culture in the 15 and 1600s. So that was my question. What was the impact of the printing press on law and legal culture?
Wow.
And that was it. And then after I'd done that, I developed a model for the examination, you know, a sort of framework for the examination. So after I'd done the doctorate and after I'd had it published as a book, I wrote the book that I really wanted to write about digital technologies. And that book is a standard text in many universities in the UK, but it hasn't had any reception here in New Zealand. And, you know, a prophet is not without honour, and so on and so forth.
Except in his own home. Yeah,
But no,
Jordan Peterson plays him.
that was what the doctorate was about, and it was a hell of a lot of fun, and I was proved right not to do digital technologies because over the time that I was doing my preparation and study and research and so on and so forth, Facebook happened.
Right. Yeah, Jordan Peterson compares the advent of podcasts to the advent of the printing press in terms of how much of an impact it has, because suddenly you've got people who are driving forklifts can be absorbing lectures on things. And I certainly found that it really opened my mind. Well, let's
I put it bigger than that, but anyway, that's
right.
for another time.
That's for another time. Well, thanks so much, both of you, for taking time out of your day to have a chat with us. And Rachel, look forward to your show next week. And Dr. David Harvey, a great privilege as always to have
Thank you, Marty.
access to your legal mind. I appreciate it more than Willie Jackson does, I can tell you
Well, you're prepared to listen, Marty. That's it.
that. Have a great week.
Thank you, Marty.
Yes, see ya.
Take care. Bye-bye,
Bye-bye.
Rachel. See you again.
See ya, David.